Races of Britain by John Beddoe, Part 7. The Normans. The racial character of the immigration, which is commonly and for shortness called Norman, requires some consideration. The army of the conqueror was drawn not only from Normandy, but from several other provinces of France. Flanders and Brittany seem to have been very largely represented therein, and Maine, the Isle of France, Champagne, Anjou, Burgundy, and more remote regions contributed in smaller degree. The Normans, however, William's own subjects, were by far the largest element. This is shown, among other indications, by the small number of tenants in capite whom he established in England, who cannot be traced, certainly or probably, to noble Norman houses. Many of William's foreign mercenaries forsook him during his northern campaigns, and Breton ballads tell us of the return of the Breton soldiery to their homes. It is noteworthy that the surname of Norman is not common in England nowadays, nor was it common in the South Midlands, at least when the Hundred Rolls were compiled, though Breton and Le Breton were very frequent, and Francis and Fleming moderately so, and there was a sprinkling of Picards and Maynards and Champenoises. Moreover, Norman was in use, especially among the English, as a Christian name. There are many Normans mentioned in the Domesday Book. Where the word came to be used as a surname, it was usually, I think, a patronymic. The inference seems to be that Norman birth and origin were too common in England after the conquest to furnish a means of distinguishing individuals, but that this did not apply to the other provinces of northern France. The Normans of the duchy were themselves a mixed breed, and the component elements were the same, or very similar, to those which entered into the English race, but their character, mainly perhaps from their peculiar history, but partly from a mixture of the elements in different proportions, did not much resemble that of the people they subjugated. To form the Norman race, the Scandinavians, the Saxons Bajacassines, and the native Cymro Celts had all contributed, but the part of the Scandinavians in the mixture had been more important than in southern England, and that of the Saxons less so. The proportions were, I think, nearer to those found in another very forcible combination, I mean the Lowland Scotch. The following are details of the elements. 1. The Gauls, whom the Romans found here, belonged partly, at least, to the Belgic Confederation, which included the right bank of the Seine, if not more. The Belgae were, we believe, a tall and rather long-headed race, whether they owed their dolichocephaly entirely to continual immigrations of the blonde northern type, or whether the southern or Iberian longheads had left many representatives there, I will not say. The short, round-headed, dark race of France, the true Celts of Broca, were doubtless also represented, but chiefly on the left bank of the Seine. 2. The influence of the Roman rulers of the country would be but slight. 3. Large numbers of Saxons were planted in Normandy in the latter days of the Empire, or settled there subsequently of their own accord. Bayeux was the capital of the settlement, which probably extended to the Cotentin. About Bayeux, they bore so large a proportion to the prior occupants that they were able, as in England, to propagate their language, which endured till the 10th or 11th century. They were doubtless of the familiar physical types, the tall, grave row, and the more compact Batavian one, their heads generally long, their complexions and hair light. 4, the Scandinavian conquerors were partly Norwegian and partly Danish, the former especially numerous about the Seine, where Rollo's companions chiefly settled, the latter in the Cotentin, where Harald Bluetooth's army found lands to their liking. Physically, they must have been among the purest specimens of that restless, roving, adventurous type of man, blond or rufous, with straight profile and elliptical head, which evermore crops up among the people of the west of Europe whenever deeds of adventurous daring have to be done. Scandinavia seems to have exhausted itself and its race by the swarming efforts of the 9th, 10th, and 11th centuries. Great part of the old kingly race, the sons of Woden, and of Skurf, and Skjold, and so many other mythical heroes, either emigrated or perished, and kindred, but not identical, breeds of men, occupied their ancient seats. The spirit of adventure died out in Norway for generations after Harald Hardrada and Magnus Barefoot, and after Hakon the Good. Doubtless, the Norman leaders were in the main of true Scandinavian blood, but the rank and file must have resembled the Normans of the present day, a crafty, capable, energetic, brave, and industrious people, presenting, among numerous variations, two leading physical types. Of these, one prevails to the east of the Seine, and is that described by W. Edwards as Cymric, with little modification. The men are tall, long-faced, aquiline-nosed, with square forehead and usually darkish hair. The other is more abundant about Caen, Bayeux, and Coutances, where the men are very generally fair and resemble the people of the north of England. At Cherbourg, fine specimens of the Anglo-Danish type are particularly abundant. I have prepared a table of the colours of hair and eyes in several provinces of France in which Normandy is largely represented. It will be seen that precisely where the history and politics of Normandy show that the Scandinavian and Saxon elements were strong, i.e. along the coast to the west of the Seine, there light colours of hair abound, and that they gradually darken as one travels eastwards or inland. Also, that on the whole the hair is rather darker than in most parts of England, but lighter than in Wales and the West. Head measurements are much needed, but Brocker found the index of breadth of 53 skulls from St. Arnold, Calvados, to be 78.77. a proportion larger than is prevalent in any part of Britain, but well within the limits of mesocephaly. That of the Norman aristocracy may probably have been smaller, but the ecclesiastics of Norman or French nationality, who abounded in England for centuries after the conquest, and who, in many cases, rose from the subjugated Celtic layer of population, have left us a good many broad and rounded skulls. Thus, the crania of three bishops of Durham, Ralph Flambard, Geoffrey Rufus, and Richard de Kellaway, yield an index of 85.6, while those of eight Anglian canons, dating from before the conquest, yield one of 74.9. So far, however, as the actual conquest and armed occupation of England was concerned, the aristocracy and military caste, who were largely of Scandinavian type, came over in much larger proportion than the more Belgic or Celtic lower ranks, insomuch that it has been said that more of the Norman noblesse came over to England than were left behind. Bretons came over in large numbers, as was just now said, and some remained. One would expect to meet with them, especially in Richmondshire, or in the great barony of Judicaille of Totnes, a Breton lord who had large grants in South Devon, but whose principal tenants bore Norman rather than Breton names. The speech in that district was then, and long after continued to be, Cornish, and an immigration of Bretons would hardly leave lasting traces among a people so nearly identical with themselves in language and not very dissimilar in physical type. The Bretons have been carefully studied by Brocker and by Guibert of Saint-Brieuc, and I have myself made about 800 observations on their colours. The prevailing type in Brittany is short, sturdy, and swarthy, with dark brown or even black hair, but pretty often with blue or grey eyes. The heads are short and broad, though less so than in central France, and the face often corresponds, the features being coarse and broad, and sometimes mongoloid. Everywhere, however, there is a minority with well-marked Cymric features and longer heads, and this minority, who nearly resemble our Cornish folk, are especially numerous in the district of the Lyonnais on the northern coast, where the colonists of the 5th century are supposed to have landed from the British Isles. Brocker obtained average breadth indices of 82 and 81.2 from two large series of skulls from the eastern and the northwestern parts of Brittany, respectively. Frenchmen, that is, people from the dominion of the King of France, then comparatively small, and Picards, Maynards, Angevins, etc., came over in smaller numbers. The seigneurs of France, still at that time, retained a good deal of the old Frankish blood, but their followers, the men to whom national surnames would generally be applied, had very little of it. They must have added a little to the Celtic and Cymric elements in the English people. Flemings of Franco-Frisian or Belgo-Frisian breed, and therefore on the whole Teutonic in blood as well as in speech, came in large numbers under William Rufus and Henry I, and settled en masse in the southern half of Pembrokeshire, in Gower, and in the Low Country of Glamorgan, where they consolidated the power of the Norman lords and easily adopted the English language, so near akin to their own. They are thought to have spread up the Tavy into Emlyn, where the mixed breed is said to be tall and comparatively fair. Here, the Welsh language has completely prevailed. In those districts where English became and continued the common speech, local names as Flemingston, Reynoldston, etc., still testify to the settlement of the colony, and some surnames of Flemish type, Jenkins and Watkins, have gradually spread among the Welsh themselves by intermixture or adoption. The descendants of the colony, somewhat mixed with English and other elements, are said to resemble the English rather than the Welsh in their steadiness, candour, common sense, and rather commonplace turn of mind. In person also, some differences are yet observable. There is more of light and less of dark hair in South Pembrokeshire and in the coastlands of Glamorgan than anywhere else in South Wales, and the general aspect and features do not differ, in the majority, from ordinary English types. Professor van der Kinder, after visiting South Pembrokeshire, told me the people looked to him rather English than Flemish.
Tuned in to Radio Stormer on the DailyStormer.com.
The main facts of the history of the Norman conquest may be briefly dismissed. Its ethnological details, though, require careful investigation. Within about 4 years after the Battle of Hastings, the whole of England had been overrun by the Gallo-Norman soldiery. The English aristocracy had been to a great extent cleared away and a new one planted in its stead, and the free population of Yorkshire and Lancashire nearly exterminated. Great gaps had been made by fire and sword in some other counties, but these were such as might probably be soon filled up by expansion from neighbouring districts, which was not the case in the desolated Deira. Cumberland and Westmoreland probably received a considerable addition to their population from the fugitives, and the same was the case with the Scottish lowlands, especially, we may suppose, the Lothians, which received at this time a more Danish colouring than they had had before, the exiles being mostly Anglo-Danes, bearing such names as Thor, Sigmund, Dolfind, Arkel, Orm. The dynastic struggles which followed the death of Malcolm Canmore, and which did not altogether cease until the beginning of the 13th century, favoured the gradual introduction of an aristocracy, chiefly Norman, from England, and of an Anglo-Saxon middle class. These, reinforced by settlers from Norway and from Flanders, spread gradually over the whole of the lowlands, from the south northwards and from the east westwards. To this movement was due the Saxonisation of Fife and the eastern coastlands as far as Nairn, the towns being first settled and the new language gradually spreading into the rural districts. The expulsion of a numerous body of Flemings from England on the accession of Henry II, nearly coinciding in time with the suppression of one of the several Moravian insurrections, gave Malcolm IV opportunity to introduce a colony of them into the Lay of Moray, which was in a short time so thoroughly settled that the remains of the Moravians, who were confined to the hill country, came to look upon it as a land of foreigners and their own lawful prey. Many Flemings also settled at Aberdeen, where such places as Kirkton and Moorcroft are already mentioned in the charters of King David. In the Garioch, they were less numerous, for the Gaelic language long continued to preponderate in that quarter. Comparatively few foreign settlers, unless possibly from Norway, arrived in Scotland after the reign of the fourth Malcolm. At that period, the new colonists, who received the general name of Saxons, were in possession of little more than the towns and strongholds in the lowlands north of the Forth. W. E. Robertson, than whom there is no better authority, thinks there was little introduction of new blood at any time beyond the towns. But the whole of Scotland, south of the Forth and the Clyde, except Galloway, Carrick, and the western half of Dumfriesshire, was by this time more Saxon than Celtic. The Strathclyde Welsh and the Galwegian tongue were giving way very gradually, though the proportion of new blood introduced in that quarter may not have been very large, in spite of the appearance here and there of such place names as Dolfinton and Symington, the settlements of Dolfin and Sigmund. And from this region, but especially from Lothian, probably now pretty thickly peopled, went on that continual northward movement of the lowland gentry, exemplified in the history of the families of Dunbar, Lindsay, Oliphant, Sinclair, Keith, Gordon, Maul, Menzies, Cummin, Burnett, Fraser, and many others, and which implies the settlement of many of their south country vassals and dependents on the lands newly assigned to them, whether previously vacant or newly wrested from their Celtic occupants, for the foreign lords, with dispossessed and wrathful Gaels, lowering from behind the neighbouring hills, it must have felt the need of support at hand in the shape of henchmen and free tenants. The Gaelic language slowly rolled back before the Saxon tide for fully 200 years, till about the close of the 13th century, the ambition of Edward I began those troubles which threw back Scotland more than a century in the march of civilisation. The Anglo-Norman conquest of South Wales was begun AD 1087, when Robert FitzHammond arrested the Low Country of Glamorgan from Jestin. Brecon and the Vale of Usk were seized soon after, and for about two centuries, South Wales was continually being fought over. In what we now call North Wales, the frontier of Salop was first advanced by Baldwin de Montgomery, who built the castle that bears his name and subdued a large tract of Powisland. But beyond that, a little advance was made until the final conquest of the country by Edward I. Very little new blood, therefore, was introduced into North Wales, where even the lords of the land continued to be Welsh, generally speaking. In the south, there was a larger infusion of French and English, but even there, the effects on language, place names, and physical type would have been small, but for the introduction of solid bodies of Flemings, as mentioned in the last podcast, into South Pembrokeshire and the coastlands of Glamorgan. These last, mixed with settlers from the west of England, succeeded, as mentioned before, in constituting a kind of small nationality in the Little England beyond Wales. We have now to inquire, what was the effect of the conquest on the proportion and distribution of race? There exists in Domesday a large mass of material bearing on this subject, but which has never hitherto, I think, been specially utilised for this end by those who have written upon it. Nearly two centuries later, when the full effect upon the English race of the intercourse with France, brought about by the conquest, had been developed and experienced, the Hundred Rolls, which for some counties give us the surnames and agrarian position of almost every male adult, are of very great value. This value was pointed out by the anonymous author of the volume entitled The Norman People, but he did not thoroughly work out the vein of evidence he had discovered, and the inferences he drew from it were more or less unsound. Domesday furnishes us with a number of separate properties in land held in the time of Edward the Confessor. Very generally, it adds the name of the owner. It also gives, as a rule, the number of burgesses or of burgage tenures in the towns, as we have reason to think that in the rural population, almost every man above the rank of a churl, almost every man who was free, according to the definition of freedom, which had come into vogue, was a possessor of land, we might thus obtain, but for two hindrances, a pretty close approximation to the number of freemen. These hindrances are, first, that where there were several owners in a manor, they are often described by number only, and not by name. Thus, seven nameless thanes are stated to have held the manor of Leeds, and it is impossible to be certain whether some or all of these seven may not have held other and separate estates in the neighbourhood to which their names may be attached in Domesday. The second is the absence of surnames, except for a few distinctive nicknames, such as are borne by Ulward Wit and Chippingus Dives, and very rarely the name of the man's father, as in the case of Ogre, the son of Ungamar, or an honourable addition, such as that of Child, Svenkilt. The Saxon system of nomenclature was perhaps the original Aryan one. It closely resembled the Greek, and afforded almost as much opportunity for distinctive variety as a single name system could. In fact, it surpassed in convenience such a double name system as the modern Welsh labour under. Still, it is often impossible to know whether in neighbouring manors we have to deal with, say, one, two, or three Sewards or Alcees or Godwins. In the table I have constructed to illustrate this chapter, I have accordingly distinguished the named from the nameless landowners, and have also separated all repeated names, whether supposed to belong to separate individuals or otherwise. The rough estimate of the actual number of individuals which follows in the next column may no doubt err widely from the truth, but it is far from being so baseless as may at first sight appear. It is conjectural, but grounded on analogies. In Somerset and Dorset, I have made great use of Eyton's laborious and valuable work. In the other counties, I have had no such assistance. It is a trite remark that there was far more of individual freedom in the Danish north than in the Saxon south, that in the north absolute slaves were few or none, and in the southeast not many, in the west very numerous, and that the free men below the rank of thane outside the burghs were almost confined to the north and east, i.e. to the Danelaw. There was not, however, very much difference in the proportional number of landowners of the rank of thane. In estimating this proportion, it must be remembered that the total set down in the last columns of the table represents the whole number of male adults enumerated in the survey. To estimate the entire number of male adults, we must allow a considerable addition for soldiers, serving men in towns and castles, inmates of monasteries, etc. In this way, Eyton brings his computation for Dorset up to 9,000, correlative to a total population of, say, 35,000 or 40,000. This may fairly enough be taken also for the population in the time of the Confessor, as Dorset had suffered very little from warfare in the interim. But the case had been very different with the northern counties, and particularly with Yorkshire. There, the East Riding had fallen off in annual value about three quarters, and in population, probably almost as much, and Ilbert de Lacy's barony, though not so miserably desolated as most parts of Yorkshire, had lost a full half in value, and probably nearly as much in population. Briefly, we may conjecture that the free landowning population had varied, in the time of King Edward, from about 1.5% in the East Riding to 3% in Somerset and Dorset, and 4 to 4.5% in the hilly and less fertile districts of Derbyshire and the West Riding. In Kent, too, selected as an English and un-Celtic country, with some peculiarities of tenure, the number of proprietors had been large. In the district analysed, it had been 3%, not including the large number of sookmen, who in Kent were generally small freeholders, holding of the king directly, not, as in the north, free tenants holding of a lord, to which latter status the surviving sookmen of Kent were reduced after the conquest. These 3 or 4% of landowning nobles and squires can hardly have been the sole legitimate posterity in blood and status of the original Anglo-Saxon invaders. True it is that military aristocracies tend to decline in numbers owing to their being exposed to the accidents of war and to their jealousy in circumscribing the marriages of their women. Such deadly feuds as that one we hear of in Wessex about AD 755, which cost the lives of all the comites of two princes, Cynewulf and Cynehyrd, would aid the process of reduction materially. But Akerman's remark, already quoted, as to the small percentage of Saxon graves containing the sword, the supposed gnomic sign of an Earl Cundman, may be trusted, probably, to prove that, then as well as at the date under consideration, this class was a small minority. The table has, therefore, little retrospective bearing. According to the Anglo-Saxon way of thinking, every man of birth and standing had, or ought to have had, land of his own, and the more, the better. Owing partly, we may suppose, to a commendation on the part of small and weak men, partly to greed of land and power on that of the strong and nobly born, we find already enormous estates on which, in the south of England at least, no tenant appears who is designated in Doomsday otherwise than as a villain or bawdar. I cannot but think that the condition of these villains must have varied greatly on different manors. Seebohm gives instances taken from the Rhenish lands, conquered by the Franks and the Alemanni, in which freemen, holders of entire manors, as well as holders of small parcels of land, having commended themselves to a lord, usually a spiritual one, seem to have become in some sense villains. But without undertaking the meaner kind of service, they became liable to the food rent, but not to ordinary agricultural labour. Probably, many of the villains on these great estates were, so to speak, mediatized thanes, while others were churls who had always, or at least for many generations, been in a more servile position. Certain royal manors, wherein Seebohm shows the obligations of the villains to have been very heavy, may have had been from the first, as Tidenham, one of his examples certainly had, a Celtic population. Sometimes, several thanes are found holding quite small parcels of lands, which they seem to have tilled themselves, apparently under no superior lord. Thus, the 12 thanes in Dorset, who seem to have commended themselves after the conquest to Ernulf de Histing, the grantee of their lands, and who reappear as his villains, had only about 5 vergates between them. Again, we are told that the thanes of Ernulf de Histing have not paid the geld on 3 hides and 4 acres of his estate at Amesbury in Wiltshire. This state of things might naturally arise from division of realty among sons, and again among sons' sons. Nothing is more common than to find 2 or 3 thanes holding a small estate together, and sometimes they are positively stated to be brethren. Whether the Sukman of Kent, apparently alloidial proprietors, occurring in little groups of 2, 3, 5, 6, 11, 12, and 14, sometimes with and sometimes without villains or boarders dependent on them, were of thanish or churlish blood, does not appear. Probably they were of the latter. In one case, Ulwil Vild, a Sukman, seems to have held a considerable estate, valued at £10, 10 shillings yearly, as a lodium, but generally these properties were very small. In Kent, the entire nobility and squirearchy, to use a bit of modern slang, which fairly expresses the class, had been dispossessed, with a very few exceptions, mostly on abbey lands. The Bishop of Bayeux held the manors of nearly 100 English proprietors, the names of none of whom reappear as his grantees, the only new tenants of manors mentioned being Norman, and in a few instances French-named men appear as small tenants, one with a mill, another with a wood, worth 3 shillings and 4 pence. Yet there are indications that the actual farmers of the lands were sometimes middlemen between the lords and the villains, and these were probably native. A single exception, a genuine Udala, occurs under the manor of Hageli. In this manor, a freeman holds 20 acres of land, worth 5 shillings yearly. He is called a luret, and does not belong to the manor, nor could he have any lord except the king. Let us trust that he survived to hound Bishop Odo out of the country.